Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Your regular financial contributions make it possible for Beth Emmanuel to make D. Thomas Lancaster's weekly sermons available online. We genuinely appreciate your support and hope that you are blessed by these teachings. Feel free to download these audio files and share them with your friends and family. Please consider joining Beth Emmanuel's extended virtual family and support our efforts for the kingdom with a gift by clicking on the Donate tab at BethEmmanuel.org.
So I would like you to turn to our Torah portion this week, Parshat Ki Tisa. We'll just look at one story. Actually, this is the story of the apostasy of the golden calf. So Exodus chapter 32 is where I'm going to be reading from, where we pick up the story. After Moses has broken the tablets and returned then to the camp of Israel, and he's taken down the golden calf, and so on. And it says in verse 25, "And when Moses saw that the people had broken loose, for Aaron had let them break loose, to the derision of their enemies, then Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, 'Who is on the Lord's side? Come to me.' And all the sons of Levi gathered around him. And he said to them, 'Thus says the Lord God of Israel, put your sword on your side, each of you, and go to and fro from gate to gate throughout the camp, and each of you kill his brother and his companion and his neighbor.' And the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses. And that day about 3,000 men of the people fell. And Moses said, 'Today you have been ordained for the service of the Lord, each one at the cost of his son and his brother, so that he might bestow a blessing upon you this day.'" It's a difficult story. It's a difficult passage. And it connects into what I wanted to speak about with you today. As I've often mentioned, one of the things I like to do, I find inspiration in reading the journals and writings of the founders of modern Messianic Judaism, which is our religion, that's what we do here. And you know, these great luminaries, these Jewish believers who emerged from the late 19th century and early 20th century European Jewish world, blazing the trail, reopening Abraham's ancient wells, walking the path, those paths that no one had dared to tread since the sect of the Nazarenes disappeared 13 centuries earlier. And I have certain favorites among those men who shape my thinking. They shape my thinking and my theology and many things. These are heroes to me. The two Lichtensteins, Levertov, Theophilus Lucky, Moshe Emanuel Ben-Meir, Avram Polyak, to name my tops. And when reading these men, particularly Levertov and Polyak, I'm able to sympathize with their plight very often. Because these guys were attempting, at least these two were attempting to form community, messianic synagogues, much like we are, fueled by a vision for restoration, but ultimately disappointed again and again, and yet never giving up. Always with one foot in this world and one foot in the kingdom. Excommunicated from their people, cut off from their families, hated by the people that they loved, rejected and laughed at by traditional Christianity, all for the sake of our Master's name. Men of whom this world was not worthy. So from time to time, as you know, I like to bring you some of their words, some of their thoughts, as they're often directly pertinent to our situation here in Hudson, Wisconsin. As our small, beleaguered community weathers storm after storm, summoned by angels, plagued by demons. So it's in that spirit that I want to bring you a few thoughts from Avram Polyak on a subject that was important to him, and that is the subject of Jewish assimilation. He lived in the tail end of the Enlightenment era, you know, the Haslacha, at the time of the late 19th century, early 20th century world, when Jewry shook off the constraints of Judaism and discovered the Gentile world and secular thought and secular education and secular politics and secular Zionism and the end of the narrow world of Torah and Judaism. When the Jewish people said, you know what, enough with this being chosen and holy business. I just want to get a job and raise a family and be a normal person like all the normal people around me. I want to be like the nations. And as a result, many Jews left the faith to find their way into Gentile society. And the easiest way to do this was to become a Christian. To Polyak, who was himself, in his own term, a Jewish Christian, this was enormously painful to see Jews embracing Jesus, and as a result, or as a consequence of embracing Jesus, leaving the Jewish people, leaving Torah, leaving Sabbath, leaving Judaism. He saw this as exactly the wrong direction. He believed that if anything, Christianity, Jewish Christianity, which is the term that he used for, you know, we say Messianic Judaism, but the term that term just wasn't vogue yet. So he said Jewish Christianity. I have a hard time saying it. He believed that Jewish Christianity should be thoroughly devoted to the scriptures. That a Jewish believer in the Messiah should be all the more zealous for the Torah, as says in Acts chapter 21. Look at all these Jewish believers, all of them zealous for the Torah. So I was interested to find some of his thoughts regarding assimilation as he wrote on behalf of his small community of believers, Jewish believers, back in 1939. And he addressed the question of Jews who were becoming Christians, assimilating and leaving behind Jewish practice, Torah, and Judaism. And I'm going to read you this passage, but before I do, I'm going to update the terminology just for my sake. Polyak did not use the term Messianic Judaism in 1939. The term was around, but it just, like I said, it hadn't become a normal term yet in English. So he uses the term Jewish Christianity, but he did not mean traditional Christianity. Rather, what he was referring to is what we refer to as Messianic Judaism. So for purposes of clarity for your own mind, I'll use that term instead when he says Jewish Christianity. This is March of 1939, the journal called The Jewish Christian Community, number 3. He says, "Our attitude towards assimilation is clear. We definitely decline it. We know the wealth of the Jewish soul and we want to preserve it. But we also know the riches in the souls of other nations, and we can therefore understand those Jews who have yielded to them and left the Jewish people. May they do so if no Hitler hinders them. If they even ask for baptism merely for assimilation's sake, we cannot sanction that, but we understand it. We understand that, too, in the same way as we try to understand all the ups and downs of a mind. It is not our business to judge what is dictated by the soul. With those baptized Jewish assimilants, we have nothing in common, but we do not deny them our respect, which is due to everyone who honestly and sincerely pursues his way, even if we decline this way for ourselves. But we can neither understand nor sanction the fact that baptized Jewish assimilants have become and are still becoming missionaries to the Jews, and that non-Aryan ministers make pronouncements about Jewish problems in a destructive way. Once these baptized Jewish assimilants have become disloyal to their people and adhere to the nations, what is causing them and who is driving them to turn around and start seducing our ranks? May they go in peace. May they preach to the Gentiles if they are listened to by them. But they should not openly become traitors to their Jewish people and seducers of the children of Israel. If baptized or unbaptized Jews consent to the idea of assimilation, they cease to be Jews and consequently have no right of any say in matters Jewish. Messianic Judaism, that means to conjoin Messiah, Jesus, to the wealth of the Jewish religion, tradition, and the Jewish soul. Messianic Judaism, that means the cross and the Star of David. That is Messianic Judaism, nothing else. That which the Jewish missionaries preach in many places is not Jewish Christianity, but assimilation and uprooting of the Jew. This attempt of cutting its roots is a great spiritual crime against the Jewish soul. As far as the Jewish mission succeed in it, they do not produce Messianic Jews, but degenerate Jews who are no asset to their people or to the church. We must differentiate between Messianic Jews and baptized Jews. By no means can we recognize Messianic Jews as Messianic Jews, all baptized Jews and descendants of Jews. A Messianic Jew is only he who consents to both the cross and the Star of David, to Jesus in the synagogue, to Jesus and Zion, Jesus and Jerusalem, Jesus and the future of Israel, according to Paul's epistle to the Romans. The baptized Jew who cannot agree to that, he may call himself what he wants, only not a Messianic Jew. There must be an end to the misuse of the Messianic Jewish name. All right, this passage, it was a long passage, I know, but it's startling and highly controversial for 1939. I'm sure he got some angry letters after publishing these words. But Polyak saw what was happening. He saw that Jews who became Christians and ceased to live as Jews and ceased to obey the commandments and no longer kept the Sabbath and the dietary laws, blah, 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 everything, you know, etc., no longer walked in the paths of Torah, the paths of our master. As it says, whoever keeps and teaches these commandments will be called great in the kingdom. He saw where this was going and it broke his heart. He saw the great potential. He saw the great potential of Messianic Judaism like city lights shining in the distance. And he believed in the vision of the Messianic synagogue. And every Jewish believer who abandoned Judaism hurt that vision. And they were lost, most painful of all, they were lost to the Jewish people. They and their children, within a generation, vanished into the church and became Gentiles. And he didn't want to condemn them for it. Rather, he said, it's not our business to judge what is dictated by the soul. He said, with those baptized Jewish assimilants, we have nothing in common, but we do not deny them respect, which is due to everyone who honestly and sincerely pursues his way, even if we decline that way for ourselves. But what he would not tolerate, what he could not respect, was when those same Jews then turned around and became missionaries to try to lure more Jews to abandon Torah and to abandon the Jewish people in the name of Jesus, the King of the Jews, using Jesus to take Jews away from the people and away from the Torah to him, to Polyak. This was sacrilege. So he opposed those type of missionaries who were only trying to make Jews into Christians, and he denied them his respect and his friendship. That stance in 1939 took great courage. In that day and age, that was an outrageous position to take. And I would say that would be a highly controversial statement to make even today in the Messianic Jewish movement, where in truth, most Messianic Jewish ministries are probably doing something pretty close to what he's complaining about. But the thing that attracted me to this piece of writing, and the reason I made you listen to that long passage, the thing that attracted me to his wisdom was not that issue per se, but rather the flip side of it. as it might be brought to bear on our own situation today in the Messianic Jewish movement, particularly the sector we occupy, which is the Gentile side of traditionalist Messianic Judaism. Let me explain. You see, here at Beth Emmanuel, we have developed a reputation for apostasy. The word apostasy means to fall away. An apostate to Yeshua is one who falls away from the Master, one who falls away from Jesus. And it is no secret that we have a reputation for breeding apostates. And our critics have been actually quite vocal about this. We are considered a portal by which people may pass through to Judaism and deny Jesus. The idea is that Christians who are otherwise loyal to our Master, they come here, they are exposed to traditional Judaism, and due to our influence in their lives, they leave Yeshua and deny our Holy Master and become Jewish. And there is some evidence of this. After nearly 10 years, we have developed a sizable list of names that we could put into that category who at one time identified themselves as disciples of our Master and today are no longer walking after him, but have instead converted and disowned him before men. And the word on the street is that this is due to our influence and due to my teaching. And on a broader scale, I have seen this happen all over the country, where so-called Messianic Gentiles learned Judaism through the ministry of First Fruits of Zion, for which I work, and then slowly adopted Jewish practice themselves until their locus of identity was no longer that of a disciple to Yeshua, but that of one who keeps Torah and mitzvot, Torah and commandments. And then eventually they found anti-missionary, anti-gospel arguments put out by the Jewish community compelling, and they ultimately converted. Particularly vulnerable were those disciples, many of whom you know, people like that came to our conferences years and years ago. Those disciples who adopted what I would call a pseudo-Jewish identity through the so-called one-law theology which we once propagated. And they adopted this Jewish identity to such an extent that when we recanted of that theology, which had made no distinction between Jews and Gentiles, they psychologically could not deal with the dissonance and the social reality that they were not Jewish, and therefore they sought some way to reconcile their Jewish lifestyle with this new incongruous realization. What they wanted more than anything was to be just part of the Jewish people and to be accepted in the synagogue, part of Klal Yisrael. And not in a spiritual Pauline sort of sense, like being grafted in and co-heirs in Messiah and that sort of thing, but in a legal, social sense, whereby they could legitimately be called Jewish, and there was only one way to reach that goal, and anti-missionary arguments against our Master offered them that route and suddenly started to sound like they made a lot of sense. And they found that if they denied him and denied the New Testament, they could be readily received into the arms of the larger community of Israel. And that was a trade-off that they deemed worth the price. So, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. That is true. That has happened. And it has troubled me for more than a decade. About a decade ago, I think I saw the first instances of it. It's not something I had ever anticipated. I never imagined that anyone who knew our Master could ever consider disowning him. It had never occurred to me that anyone who had known him, who had read his sweet words, who had felt the touch of his presence, who had prayed in his name and seen those prayers answered, it never occurred to me that one of the 12 paths of discipleship is that of Iscariot. I wondered, who are these people? Where is their loyalty? How could they abandon the one who brought them to know Israel, to know the scriptures, to know Judaism itself? They wouldn't even know what the Torah is if it wasn't for him. And I begin to wonder, what's the answer? How do we make this not happen? Would it be better to not teach them at all? Would it be better to leave them in ignorance and let them believe that as Christians they had actually replaced the Jewish people and that the Jewish people were accursed and that the Torah was canceled by Christ and that the rabbis are evil deceivers and the Pharisees vile religious hypocrites and all the pious bigotries and prejudices that make safe walls between Judaism and Christianity. And I began to understand why those walls have been put up there in the first place. I begin to understand that Christian anti-Semitism in some measure developed as a self-defense mechanism to keep Christians from assimilating into the Jewish community and leaving behind the gospel. And likewise, Jewish anti-Jesus polemics, the lies about our master, had developed for the exact same reason, as a self-defense mechanism to keep Jews within Judaism and the Jewish people and to keep them from assimilating into Gentile Christianity. And by dispelling these lies, which is what we were doing at First Fruits of Zion, we tore down those ancient walls. And when a wall is gone, people cross over. So I begin to wonder, would it be better to just perpetuate the lies? Perhaps, in some creative way, I could demonize the rabbis and denigrate the teachers of Torah and call the ways of the Jewish people the leaven of the Pharisees and pretend that Pharisees and religious Jews are all hypocritical deceivers teaching doctrines of demons, like so many Christian teachers, Hebrew roots teachers, and Messianic teachers do to this very day. And they do it for a good reason. They're keeping you safe. Should I keep you safe within the fold of Messiah by concealing the truth? But God is not a God of lies. Satan is the father of lies, and I will not serve his kingdom. I realized that I cannot be responsible for the decisions that people make, and that it would be unethical to propagate anti-Semitism and anti-Judaism, as so many Jewish roots teachers do, just to keep the safety wall standing. So I thought perhaps I should just say nothing. I will neither tell lies nor the truth. I will clasp my hand over my mouth. I will teach only the gospel, pure and simple. I know nothing but Christ and Christ crucified. But the problem is that I found the gospel pure and simple to be purely and simple first century Judaism. Incomprehensible outside of that context. The natural habitat, so to speak, of the gospel. And I can't teach Yeshua without teaching the Jewish people. They are inseparable. So I decided to teach what has been given to me and let people make their own choices where they will choose. I bring you, like our master says, not a message of peace. I bring a sword. And it has been a sword. For the word of God is living and active, sharper than any two-edged sword, piercing to the division of spirit and soul, joints and marrow, discerning the thoughts and the intentions of people's hearts. I reject the allegation that we are a portal for conversion to Judaism and denying the Master. We stand and we have always stood steadfast for Yeshua and have never sanctioned the whisperings of those who come and ask questions, like who question Paul, question his authority. Who says the New Testament should be our authority? Much less those who turn their back on the Master. God forbid it. And make no mistake, the teaching you hear from us is not Yeshua optional. We are and always have been gospel-centered, kingdom-centered, teaching devotion to the Master, the Son of God, salvation in His name, forgiveness of sins by His suffering, hope for the life of the world to come by His resurrection. The only name by which men may be saved. You've not heard otherwise from the leaders of this community. Those who have gone out from us have not done so on the basis of our teachings, but rather under the influence, in some cases, in many cases, of other congregants who walked in the sandals of Iscariot and opposed us at every turn. And many who came to us were already well down the path. They came not because we offered them a portal to conversion, but because as one of the only traditionalist messianic synagogues in the world, we were their last stop on their way out the door. They were already detaching from the vine. And they came to us saying, we accept the Master, but we don't accept Paul. We accept Matthew, but we don't accept John. We accept the sages, but we don't accept the authority of the apostles. And nonsense like that. We were their last stop in the body of Messiah. And so, you know what? I'm sad. It always makes me sad. It makes me sad, but our Master said this, that there are four types of disciples who sit before Him. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and doesn't understand it, one comes, the evil one comes and snatches away what was sown in his heart. This is the one who is the seed that was sown by the road. And the one that's sown on rocky places is the man who hears the word and he receives it with joy. But he has no firm root in himself. He is only temporary. And the one on whom the seed was sown among the thorns, this man who hears, he's the man who hears and he grows, but the world and its deceitfulness choke him and he becomes unfruitful. But the one seed that was sown on good soil, this is the man who hears the word and understands it and bears fruit and brings forth 160, 30-fold. The meaning of that parable that you know so well is that one out of four disciples of Yeshua actually stay with Him to grow to maturity. That is the message. The most difficult part of this has been actually not the loss of these brothers and sisters, but what to do with them after that. That is the hardest part of the equation. To determine what to do with those who deny our Master, God forbid. How do we relate to them? Those who have been our devoted friends, who we called brother and sister, who broke bread with us, who shared joys with us and trials with us. As David says, even my close friend in whom I trusted, who ate my bread, he has lifted his heel against me. And he says, it is not an enemy who taunts me, that I could bear. It is not an adversary who deals insolently with me, then I could hide from him. But it is you, a man, my equal, my companion, my familiar friend. We used to take sweet counsel together. Within God's house, we walked together. I thought about this. My first thought was that, well, you know, painful as an amputation is, sometimes that's how you have to stop the spread of an infection. And that is the answer that traditional Judaism gives for Jews who become believers. They're cut off from the community. It's radical. You're considered dead. They'll have a funeral for you. Why? It's a deterrent. It's a deterrent, a social deterrent, a message that says there are social consequences to the decisions that you make. Yes, you are free to make your decisions, but there is a social price to pay. And more importantly, in my mind, it's to stop the spread of the influence, that they should not infect others with the spirit of apostasy. That's how the Jewish community deals with people like us. But I don't think that's a good idea. I mean, that might have worked in the shtetls, but I don't think that works today. And it doesn't work for a variety of reasons. One of the reasons is that everyone thinks to himself that he's more noble than that. This is like, yes, but I'm more Christ-like and more Christian and more loving. And everyone thinks that if he continues to keep relationship with those who have abandoned the fellowship and left the assembly, you know, that's the thing to do. And so the cancer continues to spread. We don't have the loyalty to one another that it would require to do something like that. Because our strongest loyalty is always to those who are most disloyal to us. Everyone who has ever left this community with a complaint against us has always been coddled by the community. You know it's true. In the name of love, they have been allowed to spread hate. That's the way it is. I accept that, and I'm good with it. But the social reality of today's world means you can't do amputations. How do you do an amputation and have Facebook at the same time? The disaffected always turns out to be the victim. The leadership is always the perpetrator. These are simple equations. These are simple social equations. But you know what? We're not just talking about disloyalty to Beth Emanuel, because that's really not a big deal. That's an irrelevant thing. Whether you like the leadership of Beth Emanuel or not, that's one thing. But denying the master is a big deal. That's another thing entirely. And I understand it. I mean, I understand it. I understand how even in that case, you know, these are your friends. These are your neighbors. And in any case, we should also love our enemies, right? And if we should love our enemies, how much more so should we love the former brother or sister who has stumbled? I believe that. That's true. And I think we need to do that. Nevertheless, there is a difference. Or at the very least, there should be a marked difference in the quality of these relationships. Yes, we are still obligated to love the apostate who falls away from our master, as it says, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." And an apostate is still your neighbor, but not more so than your next door neighbor, or the grocer, or the barber. But regarding those who are still disciples, our master doesn't say, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." He says, "You shall love one another as I have loved you," which is a much higher love, a sacrificial, fraternal love, a brother and sister fierce loyalty that we as disciples are called upon to demonstrate toward one another, that the world may know that we are his disciples by our love for one another. A fierce loyalty, a family loyalty as brothers and sisters and sons of daughters of one household. And that loyalty should remain within the family and not be shared with others who have disowned the family. As it says in the Proverbs, "Should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets, let them be yours alone and not for strangers with you. Why should you, my son, be exhilarated with an adulteress?" And this is why I thought that we could learn from the wisdom of Avram Polyak. Now, our problem is almost identical to the one he addressed, only in reverse. like an image in a mirror. Our problem is not that we see a lot of Jewish believers, you know, being assimilated. God willing, we should have such a problem. You know, would that we had enough Jewish believers that that was a concern. Our problem is Messianic Gentiles who are being assimilated into Judaism and consequently disowning our master. So I'm going to do this. You have to let me. Let me read you the same passage from Polyak's journal, but this time I'm going to mess with it and reverse some of the terminology to bring it directly to bear on our situation and see if the wisdom does not resonate with you. Our attitude towards disowning our master and converting to conventional Judaism is clear. We definitely decline it. We know the wealth of every disciple's soul, and we want to preserve it. But we also know the riches in the souls of the Jewish people and can therefore understand those disciples who have yielded to them and left the body of Messiah. If they even ask for conversion merely for assimilation's sake, we cannot sanction it, but we understand that too, in the same way as we try to understand all the ups and downs of a mind. It's not our business to judge what is dictated by the soul. With those who have disowned our master, we have nothing in common. But we do not deny them our respect, which is due to everyone who honestly and sincerely pursues his way, even if we decline this way for ourselves. But we can neither understand nor sanction the fact that some of those who have disowned him have become and are still becoming missionaries to the believers, and that Gentile converts make pronouncements about Messianic Jewish problems in a destructive way. Once these ex-Messianics have become disloyal to their people and adhere to conventional Judaism, what is causing them? Who is driving them to turn around and start seducing our ranks? May they go in peace. May they preach to the Jewish people if they are listened to by them. But they should not openly become traitors to the body of Messiah and seducers of his disciples. If Gentile converts consent to the idea of disowning Yeshua, they cease to be our brothers and sisters, and consequently have no right of any say in matters pertaining to us. There's wisdom here. Disciples are called upon to love, not to revile. And those who despised our master, those who despise our master are not to be despised by us. For he himself, while being reviled, did not revile. And when despised by others, he did not despise. The amputation is the easy thing. I fear that's the human, carnal, fleshly reaction, the easy reaction to an apostate, the safest route. But it's also the same path to anti-Semitism, to rebuilding the walls, to hatred of Jews in general. For if we become bitter against the converts, we must also become bitter towards the Jewish people in general. For the convert has become a Jew and needs to be respected, therefore, on that basis. The same as you would respect any Jewish person as a member of Israel. But the matter is entirely different when that convert turns around and tries to maintain old relationships he once enjoyed when he was a disciple. Let him go in peace, but let him not try to maintain friendship, kinship, brotherhood with brothers and sisters that he has disowned. You cannot leave the Messiah and still have the body of the Messiah. We are the same thing. If they call the head of the household Beelzebub, how much more so the members of the household? So let me ask you this. How many brothers and sisters have to fall away before we will learn not to fraternize with apostates, and especially those who seek to seduce us? I know you want to be loving, and I know you want to show everyone love, but intimate love Like brothers and sisters within the body are obligated to show one another. Intimate love without boundaries is not love. It's called debauchery and infidelity. I'm not saying that a Jew who doesn't believe in Jesus would not be welcome and loved in our midst. That would be crazy. We are a messianic synagogue. That would be quite backwards. But the matter is different with a disciple who has consciously disowned our master. Go in peace. I wish them peace. And that Hashem may guide them on whatever path he has prepared for their souls. And I don't judge them, and I don't sit in judgment over them or over the fate of their souls. But we must not behave as if this is a matter of little consequence. We must not tolerate fellowship with those who want to draw others away from Yeshua. Ironically, born Jews don't act that way. Most do not. Born Jews do not try to proselytize. I have never had a Jewish friend, a Jewish rabbi, that was born Jewish, ever try to convince me to abandon faith in Yeshua. In all of my relationships, in all of my years. So what is motivating these ex-brothers and sisters on their campaign? Fear. They are afraid that they made a mistake. So they must continually convince themselves that they made the right decision. And the way that they do that is by convincing you. Our master says, you travel over land and sea to make one proselyte, and when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves. This is no game. We are playing for keeps, and we are wrestling against powerful spiritual forces. Our master has warned us, if you disown me before men, I will disown you before my Father in heaven. Do we know what that means? No, we don't. Do we want to find out? No, we don't. How many disciples have suffered anathema, excommunication, persecution, torture, martyrdom for the sake of not denying his name? Does their example mean anything? Hasn't he said, if anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away as a branch and dries up, and they gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burned. No more. So watch yourself. Remember Peter? Peter said, even though I'll fall away because of you, I will never fall away. That was what Peter said. Even though all apostatize, I will never. And then he said, even if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. And then all the other disciples said the same thing too. And that night, they all fled and they all abandoned him. And Peter denied him three times. And it says in John chapter 6 that our master said, this is why I told you no one can come to me unless it's granted to him by the Father. And after this, many of his disciples turned back and no longer walked with him. So Jesus said to the 12, do you want to go away as well?
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.